ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day. Hamish McDonald here. I'm a journalist and I've spent the last 18 months deep in the dark world of mis- and disinformation. So, what is the difference? Well, disinformation has malicious intent behind it. It's designed specifically to deceive using false information, kind of like propaganda. Whereas misinformation is false information that might be shared by someone who believed it to be true. So, who's behind this modern form of propaganda? Find out by streaming The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
G'day, Alan Kohler here, and this week on That's Business, the man with a few million futures in his hands, the CEO of Australian Super, Paul Schroeder. It's Australia's biggest superannuation fund, with more than $400 billion under management. And a note from me here, if you think a superannuation is boring, and the people who run it must be boring too, well, you'd be wrong. Paul Schroeder is not boring, both from the lens of the major business he runs and the world he sees around him. He's got plenty to say on the state of the Australian economy and its direction, the not-so-minor front of geopolitics and how it plays with business and investment, including AusSuper's efforts to invest internationally, as well as the super system itself, which is a topic with plenty of politics around it. And perhaps most importantly and most passionately for Paul, the three big things facing Australia are productivity, inequality, and housing. And he reckons housing is the biggest one of all on that list, that it's a major problem. But don't worry, I challenge him on a few of these worldviews. You'll have to keep listening to find out which of them, and ask him to unpack what the role of superannuation and AusSuper in particular might have to help solve the housing problems that he himself identifies. Here's Paul Schroeder, the CEO of Australian Super. Well, g'day, Paul Schroeder. Thanks for joining us on That's Business.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I'm sure there are times when the responsibility of looking after the earnings of 3.6 million Australians weighs more heavily than others. And I guess this is one of those times. So I just wonder, how do you approach uncertainty and volatility like we're seeing at the moment? I mean, do you go looking for opportunities to buy, or do you head into the grandstand to watch the play from there for a while?
Well, you make a very important point about the responsibility of investing people's retirements. And as you say, it's 3.7 million people. So,
it's 3.6. So it's 3.7.
Yeah, well, there you go. It is 3.7. But the weight of that is really.
Who's counting?
Well, if you think there's an Australian Super member in every fourth household, that means in my street I'm bumping into them all of the time. So just the idea of how conspicuous that is, as well as the weight of it, is real and very significant. So I think there's a how we think about it is through the lens of how do we construct the portfolio. So what's the right asset allocation for the circumstances? And then inside that, what are the kind of tilts that make sense? And then what sort of securities you buy? So that's the basic construction of how we think about it. And we think about it through a long-term horizon, because the 15-year-old who's joining the fund today, they're going to be in the fund for 70 years. So we have to think about constructing the portfolio, and we have to think about it through the prism of all of the changes that have happened and all that's to come, and to try and compress that, and then realize that you're dealing with uncertainty and you're dealing with risk, and they're different because you can price risk, but uncertainty you can't price properly. That's the whole definition of it. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about, well, has geopolitics changed? Is the way society works changed? Where will earnings be in the future? So, Alan, I'm really happy to talk about any and all of those things, but I think the most important thing is we feel very weighted.
It's true that the 15-year-old is going to be with you a long time, but the 55-year-old is going to want their money fairly soon. So you've got to watch that as well, don't you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So different cohorts and also different wealth levels. So if you haven't got very much money, you're underpinned by the government age pension, which is indexed. And it's a pretty solid proposition. So if you're a security guard on $48,000, by the time the system's mature, you'll be able to retire on about $47,000, and basically you're in really good order. If you're very wealthy, then you've got the flexibility and you've got the time and you've got the options to move around. Really, the group that I worry about the most and think the most about are people as they're getting older, who've got somewhere between $200,000 and $800,000 where there's going to be an interplay between their super balance and the age pension. And as you say, they want to spend their money.
Yeah, so let's get specific on allocations a bit. You've got more in international shares than Australian shares, 35% versus 26%.
Yeah.
But that was before the war in Iran started. That was in December. So is that changing at the moment? I mean, are you still comfortable with that much of your money in international shares?
Oh, for sure, because Australia only represents about 2% of world global markets. And so the central idea, I mean, there's only a couple of things that are absolutely proven bulletproof. One of them is that compound interest and staying invested is absolutely essential. And the second is that a properly globally diversified portfolio will always put you in better stead than a concentrated portfolio, always. And so if Australia is only 2% of global markets, it makes very strong and good sense for us to be a global investor for domestic beneficiaries. Now, it is a reasonable question to say, when the world's in some strife, does that change your mind about that? Well, then you've got to say, where are the most reliable earnings and where are the best companies in the world? And the most reliable earnings and the best companies in the world are in the United States. Now,
Is that still the case?
But importantly, some people talk about de-risking a bit in the US context because of, you know, geopolitical changes, the administration and various other things. But most of those people who are talking about de-risking in the US are talking about coming back from a portfolio. Like all those US-based fund managers and many of your listeners who are invested with US-based managers, we might be 80 or 90% exposed to the US. We're 35%. So from where Australian super members are, they can absolutely afford to, and they'd be mad not to, increase their exposures to the world's greatest companies and strongest earnings in the best domestic economy there is.
But things have changed in the US. I mean, you've got, what, something like $140, $150 billion in the US specifically, and things have changed in the past 12 months since Donald Trump was elected, right? So, I mean, has that changed your thinking about America at all?
We spend a lot of time engaging with the new administration and the old administration and understanding what's going on to the best of our ability. And by the way, the Australian government's been really good like that. Kevin Rudd and Penny Wong and Heather Ridout and others have been really good at making sure doors are open and thoughtful.
How do you engage with them? What do you do?
Thoughtfully. And alert to idiosyncratic risk.
Yeah, but what, at what level? I mean, who do you talk to?
At almost all levels, we have very good access to the administration. But I don't think I'd like to avoid being too distracted by any one politician, right? So the main thing is there's $150 trillion worth of global debt that you can invest in. There's $140 trillion worth of global equities that you can invest in, and there's about $15 trillion, this is all in US dollars, of private markets. And so you then have to think about, well, how do I get the best exposure for the members of Australian Super, Tatiana, who's got a balance of $53,000? How do I get her the best exposure so she can invest like a billionaire in the United States or in the UK? We get tremendous every government of every colour and every persuasion wants to engage with us, because we're very important investors and we're long-term investors and we take an active interest in creating wealth.
So as your funds grow from here, do you think you'll keep the same allocations? Are you looking more towards certain markets than others? Like I'm thinking particularly of emerging markets or China and so on.
That's a really important, very important perspective. The connection between Australia and Asia is one of our most tremendous advantages. And I think there's 170 people in Asia for every person in Australia. So you've got tremendous opportunity across Asia. We don't really invest by geography, by the way, Alan, in case I've implied that. We don't. We invest by asset class and then we think about securities, often in themes and often in industries. But we don't say this country or not that country. Generally speaking, we try to get a fairly representative exposure across across the globe. But Asia does represent enormous opportunities and significant opportunities for growth. But as you fully know, these things happen in cycles and in waves. But the main thing is, will Asia be a much more important driver of the global economy? Yes. Is China really the most important global partner for Australia? Categorically. That's why we have three people in Beijing, by the way. We have three macroeconomists in our Beijing office, because that's a fundamental driver of future growth. Although if you wanted to talk about that, you know, they've got some demographic challenges and some capital allocation challenges as well. But it makes sense for us to think about our time zone, and it's why we run in three hubs. So if you're an Australian super member, you've got a hub in this zone where we've got offices in Australia and in Beijing. You've got a hub in Europe because we've got a great big office in London in that time zone, and we've got a hub in New York. So that's the way we're thinking about it, three kind of hubs to be able to invest as a global investor for domestic beneficiaries, so that you know, I met a guy called Percy. He's one of 74 Percys in the fund. He's got to worry about his job and his salary, but I also need to make sure that he's got money, right? He's got to worry about his job and his salary. We've got to make sure he's got a decent balance as well, which gives him, make sure that not all his eggs are in the one basket. It means he's got access to capital markets as well as the labour market.
74 Percys, wow.
Yeah, 74 Percys, a few more if you include Percivals, but there's 74 Percys. And just to talk about the point you made at the start, I introduced myself to one of these Percys and I said, oh, you made this great speech. And I said, I'm Paul Schrader. He said, I know who you are because I'm 67 years old and I'm retiring in 3 weeks and you've got all my money. It doesn't get sharper than that, Alan.
No, indeed. Okay, all right. Let's talk about Australia now. Obviously,
you've sure,
still
please.
Got a lot of money. You're probably, I mean, according to what you're saying, with Australia's 2% of the world and you've got 26% of your funds in Australia, you're way overweight Australia, right? I mean, so you've got more in Australia than really you should have. But anyway, I mean,
I'd like to challenge that, Alan. You're right. We are overweight Australia.
No, I mean technically.
In a technical sense, you know. But we've got bigger responsibilities than just the technical.
Yeah, no, sure, I get it. So how are you feeling about Australia?
Pretty good. Australia's in, I mean, good. It depends which lens you ask through, Alan. I'm really worried about three big things for Australia. But is Australian economy going pretty well? Actually, it's going pretty well. Like, unemployment's pretty low. Inflation's a problem, but it needs to be attacked. But generally speaking, this is a pretty wealthy economy and most people, you know, go better here than in lots of other places. And most companies here are making good earnings and there's some really good companies here. So in the very macro, pretty good. But there's three things that I'm really worried about and Australian Super worries about. One is productivity and the lack of growth over the last 10 years in particular. One is inequality, because if you don't have an equal, like productivity goes to the idea of the size of the pie. The second is inequality, how well that pie is sliced up and if everybody can see a fair share in it for them. But the third, and the most dominant for me, the most pressing is housing. The housing market and the housing supply situation is completely out of whack. And if we don't act urgently about this and prioritise it, we will end up in a world where it doesn't matter how big the pie is and how much your slice is, you won't have anywhere to eat it. And that's making all of us feel very, 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 very stressed about that. So how's Australia going? Overall, pretty well. Where's debt? Pretty good. Where's the super system? Fantastic. Low cost to deliver a very good age pension system. It's got a lot going for us as a country, but what are we worried about? I'm worried about productivity, where growth has stalled. I'm worried about inequality, which really goes to the sustainability of the whole society, and I'm worried about housing, which you've written about this deeply, but it's actually, it's really fraught.
Well, let's talk about housing. I mean, you just said supply, but isn't supply a function of demand in the sense that, you know, supply is only short if there's more demand than's available housing is available. Why not look at demand as well?
Aha! Wow. And demand comes from a number of things, right? So demand comes from population growth, which is a function of birth rates plus immigration, but it also comes from household size and the changing nature of household size. The most powerful thing, there's some really important stats about housing that I think are so compelling that every human being in Australia and every policymaker should pay really deep attention to. The supply side is that in the 1990s, there were 0.75 dwellings completed, 0.75 dwellings completed for every new person, no matter how they became to be a new person, whether it's immigration or birth or anything else. It's now less than 0.4. So we are not building anywhere near enough completed dwellings per new person. So you can, as you say, you can influence that from both ends. You can think about that from both ends. The net result is, in the 70s, it used to cost you twice your household income to buy a house. In the late 90s, it was three times. And not so long ago, it was 6.5. And if you're in Sydney, it's 9.5 times. So it took you 9 years to save a deposit. It takes 11 or 12 now. The most startling thing for me is this. It should be about 30% of your income to pay for your rent.
Yep.
It should be about 35% of your income to pay for your mortgage, and they're now running at about 33.5% and 45%. So we're at the point where young people especially, or people who don't own a house, older people, there's a lot of older single women in this situation as well, so it's not only a young person problem. People can't find safe, secure, affordable places to live, and if you can't do that, you can't build any dream, you can't build any future, you can't find your place. So it is, you're right, supply and demand, but it's mostly, it's 40 years of neglect on supply.
So is the government doing enough about that?
I don't think it's just a government problem. In fact, I would say
Well, okay, I'm going to get onto what you can do about it in a minute.
Yeah, you should do that. But look, I think it's more central than that. You know how they say in casinos, the house always wins? I would say that in the financial sector, in the Australian economy, the house always wins. And the reason the house always wins is that housing prices and housing valuations underpin the entire banking system. So there's $12 trillion worth of housing in Australia. About a third of it's got a mortgage. Every one of those mortgages is underpinned by what a house is worth. So even when people get together and say, we want to improve housing affordability and we want to reduce the price of housing, it's actually nonsense. Because APRA, the regulatory environment, mortgage system, banking, the entire... Every piece of journalism is underpinned by advertising that's dependent.
And a ton of your money.
Correct. Everybody. I'm not pointing the fingers at everybody. I'm just saying the entire construct of the Australian economy is embedded in housing mortgage book. And so if you're going to deal with it, you can't just say, because everybody says, and it's right, land release, permitting, cheaper manufactured housing, get out of the way, get local councils out of the way, build. I say build, baby, build, right? You have to fundamentally arc up a supply. But John Howard said nobody wants their house to drop in value. I'm saying the entire Australian economy is built on housing as its crux. And the best example is this, a capital allocation sense. The US economy is worth $33 trillion or thereabouts. And there's about $55 trillion worth of housing, right? So there's 30 thereabouts GDP, 31.4 to be precise, of $55 trillion worth of housing. In Australia, our GDP is $2.72 trillion and housing's worth $12. This whole show is built on housing. So if we're going to be serious about it, you've got to go, the whole show is built on housing. The house is always going to win unless we say we're going to build the show on something else.
Yeah, well, so that's right. So the thing is that to make housing more affordable, the price has to either come down or not change for a while, right? So,
correct.
I mean, it's kind of, in a sense, the cat's out of the bag, right?
Well, the cat's out of the bag if everybody's serious about it, right? So is it embedded, for example, in everybody's model that we genuinely want housing to be a smaller proportion as a proportion of GDP? Is that a thing we would like because we'd rather productive capital, because we'd rather earnings capital, we'd rather turn wealth into investable job-creating things? Or is it, I'm a little bit worried about my kids and I don't want to look like my $50 million house matters too much, right? Is it just kind of like polite conversation, or is it really serious that we're prepared to reset the expectations, the measures, the targets, the valuation process?
Fair enough. So let's look at super in its role in housing. Because the thing is, your job obviously is to prepare people for retirement. But the thing is that if somebody who's 25, who's joined Australian Super, can't buy a house, right? And so they're going to rent all their lives. So when they retire, they're still renting. That's bad, right? You don't want that. So what sort of responsibility do you have to help people get into a house as well as to provide them with some super savings? I mean, what can you do? You're pretty focused on just the return on the money, right? And that's fair enough. But maybe you should be more focused than you are on whether your members have a house, own a house.
Well, the first thing is I am really focused on whether people can have houses and housing. And I do spend a lot of time advocating about it and challenging people about being much more urgent about it and understanding that it's a supply problem and that it requires much more than just government to respond. The second thing is we invest more than $20 billion across the supply chain to help with supply. So Reece Plumbing, BlueScope Steel, great companies that are going to be involved in the supply.
Paul, can I just say that, can I just interrupt here? You're investing in those businesses to make money, to provide a return. You're not investing in them. You're not investing in them to provide houses.
Yeah, but you're not suggesting to me, Alan, that I should invest in anything other than trying to make the best risk-adjusted net return for people, are you? Because I'm not prepared to do that.
No, I'm okay. Well, I am asking you because your members need to should have a house. So do you have any kind of responsibility?
Yeah, they definitely should have a house.
That's right. So do you have any kind of responsibility, not to the country as a whole, but to your members, to help them get a house?
I have an obligation and a complete commitment to make sure that people are richer in retirement, that we make them the most risk-adjusted post-fees and post-tax money that we possibly can for the longest duration. So I'm not going to do anything other than that right now. Inside that, is there a possibility to unlock things to create opportunities? I'm sure there are, right? So, for example, if we want exposure to treasuries or debt, it makes sense if we can be presented with a treasury or a debt proposition that makes risk-adjusted sense for us to invest in. That's a great way to get money to this challenge, for instance. That's a really good development. I personally think that we should be spending some more of our personal time advocating about better policy. We already invest in the supply chain. We also invest in housing, right? in especially build to rent to own, because we need to help as many people as possible to inject into the supply chain. But what I'm calling out is this central truth that as a country, we spend way, way, way too much on housing and not anywhere near enough on productive investment. And we all need to readjust how we think about that. And we've basically put, for the last 25 years, all of our additional wealth has gone into inflated housing prices that you can't really do anything about because you've got to move from one house to another house. It doesn't create any job. Probably a 10% increase in housing construction leads to a 0.4 or 0.5% increase in GDP. But we're basically operating under this myth. We spend as a country way, way, way too much on housing, and there's still not enough houses for the number of people who want to be housed. That's the central problem here.
We've got to get off this topic in a minute, but before we do, I suppose what I'm wondering is, have you thought about something like when someone joins Australian Super, one of the options would be that you would build them a house and that they would pay it off during the course of their working life. And so that by the time they, as part of their super savings, as part of their 10% or whatever, 12.5%, that would pay off the house. And by the time they retired, they would own it. What about something? So you actually go and build houses for your members that they pay off during their working life.
So I think you've challenged me to go to the right spot here, Alan, right? So are there, that's what I was trying to get to, is are there creative ways for more houses to be built in intelligent ways? Yes. Can that happen at a macro level? Yes. Might that happen at a fund level? I think it could happen at a fund level in some of the ways you described. A couple of things we need to make sure we protect against. One is you've got to make sure that other members aren't paying something that they're not getting a benefit from. So it's really important for us to have equity between members. And the next part is you have to make sure that if we were to embark on something, it's not just some sort of money-wasting white elephant. Right? But there are, I think there are ways to have super and housing, not super or housing. And what I worry about in some of the more extreme political debate is, oh, we should use super for housing. Well, no, we need super and housing. And I think there is a sweet spot where super could fund things or help fund things that might help people be housed more quickly.
Yep. Okay. All right. Well, I'll leave that in your hands. Now, I also want to talk to you about AI. Do you think AI is a bubble?
So I think when we think about AI, we have to think about we Australian Super have to think it through three lenses. The one you've just gone to, which is it an investable proposition? What does it mean to the concentration of markets? Is there strong earnings that underpin it? Is it an investable proposition? And the answer to that question is categorically yes. The second question is, as an enterprise, how do we use AI and what does that mean for our operations and does it help us make better investment decisions and can we serve members better and can we do that in a way that's good for colleagues who work here? And then the third question is, like, is AI like cataclysmic for the whole society? Like, what are jobs going to look like and how's work going to be and what's war going to be like? And we have to think about those three levels. So to answer your question about is it a bubble, earnings are really quite strong with all of those main tech companies and they've made a lot of money and they look well placed. Valuations are also high, but earnings are good. So what we're really carefully watching is some of those companies perform better than others. Some of those earnings are stronger than others. But if people weren't invested in those AI strong companies, they would have lost a lot of money. And can I make one particular point, Alan, is that people don't quite know what's going to happen with AI. I think it's going to speed the good and speed the bad. And people are worried about their jobs and their roles and their future, and we should all be very thoughtful about that through an ethical lens and thinking about society. But if you've got a job and you're getting paid and you're not sure what's happening for your job with AI, at least it's a strong and good thing that your super is investing in AI. So in a way, it's kind of like a natural hedge. You've got a bet on that AI is going to make money in your super fund and you've got your job and you're worried about what AI might mean in your job. And so I would much rather, I am a member of Australian Super, but nobody quite knows what's going to happen with AI. But what I know is the old adage that having all your eggs in one basket is bad. So the idea that you're invested in tech markets, especially in the US, and making money out of it at the same time as you're a bit worried about it, that's a better situation than being just, I've got to worry about my job here in Australia.
How much money have you got invested in AI?
Well, it's a significant proportion of the portfolio because these AI companies represent about 38% of the US stock market and they've been very high-performing funds. So it's in the multi-billions of dollars, Alan.
Okay, the second point you talked about was what's it going to do for your business? I mean, how can you use it?
Yeah.
So tell us about that. I mean, is that do you see it purely as a way of improving productivity or will it also replace some of your staff?
I think it's a really we don't think it'll need to replace staff, by the way, because we've got 2,200 employees and we're growing rapidly, so it might impact the speed of growth of employment, but we don't think of it in the way you just described. The second thing is I think it's important to distinguish between tasks and roles. There's no doubt that some tasks will no longer need to be done by people, but they'll be replaced by other higher value tasks is our core hypothesis. But If you think about through your working life, there's a lot of things you don't have to do now that you once had to do. So that those things will, there will be many tasks removed. There definitely will be many tasks that will be removed. How we're coming at it is through two primary lenses. Lots and lots of companies talk about user cases for AI. I prefer to think about the central case for AI. And the central case for AI is that AI should be able to help us solve the problem that you and I talked about at the beginning of this podcast, which is people want to be well set up for retirement and they want to move into retirement very smoothly. They want to be able to retire on Friday and be on Monday, optimally set up with the right portfolio, drawing down the right amount, having made provision for their later life, connecting the age pension with the Australian Super Pension and have done some estate planning. Now, I'm very optimistic that the combination of a great fund like Australian Super plus AI will make that so much easier, probably no need for human interaction, very smooth, much more secure, brilliant. On the other hand, when it comes to investment decision making, already Claude is letting us say, this is what this company said in all of its annual reports over the last 14 years. Here's the thing that changed. Here's the thing that rose. And our assessment is this is the thing the company's trying to hide from you. And that's produced in moments.
That's definitely going to replace human beings. Goodness me.
Well, no. Well, actually, the way I'd really talk about that is if you were stupid, you'd have it replace human beings. But if you were smart, you would say, no, if I replace the human beings, then I'll end up with nobody with any experience in understanding discounted cash flows and how to understand a balance sheet. And when it comes to it, I won't have any senior people to make the most important calls that have to be human informed. And so stupid companies will use AI just to get rid of people. Smart companies will say, what pipeline of skills and capabilities and talents will I need for this to be a very successful, very sustainable operation?
As you know better than most people, there's a lot of stupid companies around. So what's your opinion about what level of unemployment AI might end up resulting in?
I think that's a very hard thing to understand, and it does make a very big difference between blue collar and white collar work, right? So we're going to need many more electricians than we do today, and we haven't got anywhere near enough electricians. There's definitely the case that a fair bit of white collar knowledge work tasks will no longer be required, and they'll be done much faster by other people. But there's quite a look. I don't want to be an optimist or a pessimist on this. I just think there's an opportunity. It'll speed the good, it'll speed the bad, and we should be really smart to try and make sure that we don't lose things along the way. The most vulnerable actually in all of this are tech people. Technology always disrupts tech the first, and I think that's where if I was thinking about the AI challenge, I'd say if I'm an electrician, I'm in really good stead, and if I'm a tech person, I'm going to have to learn new skills.
You mentioned Claude before. Now, the bloke who created Claude, Dario Amodei, CEO of Anthropic, has been in town.
Yeah.
One of the things he's been saying for a while now, he's like, he said it a few times, is that there's a 25% chance of doom.
Yeah.
I mean, broadly defined. Like you mentioned, what's it going to do? So it's not just that. It's not just probability of unemployment, but, you know, that basically it's the end of civilization or something.
Yeah.
And he's been saying 25%. I mean, why would anyone do anything that's got a 25% chance of killing you? I mean, it seems to me that's kind of a bit of a disconnect there. Would you do anything that had a 25% chance of killing you?
Yeah, no, that sounds a pretty high risk ratio, I think. I think it's really hard because, as you say, it's sort of an extreme binary proposition that you've put. But I think if you ask the question, does AI have the potential? And actually, when we talk about AI, people very often forget quantum. It's really important to remember quantum and AI because really AI relies on compute power, and quantum is going to accelerate and completely blast the whole compute power discussion. But if I think about AI, I worry about water, I worry about power, I worry about the contest for water and power in an energy transition way. That's an important thing for us to work our way through. I do worry about the implications for workforces and people's future incomes. I think everyone should worry about war. War is always horrible. It doesn't matter what war it is. And AI will make war be able to be executed much more aggressively and much more targeted. And so, it's not unrealistic to say it could go horribly badly, but human beings are pretty good at creating policies and rules and setups and adjusting. And if I remember my economics 101, I'm the most worried about oligopsonies, which is when you've got a very small number of very powerful customers. And the concentration of companies, these hyperscalers, they sort of throw their weight around a bit too much, right? They because they've got all the money and because they've got a lot of authority and power, they then go around to countries and say, I want all your IP and I want all your land and I want – well, actually, countries need to decide how they want to live. And that is a proper role for government and parliaments.
Okay, before I let you go, I just want to talk about super. It's now kind of a bit more than 30 years since superannuation was invented. Do you think it would be a good time to have another look at it now and reassess? Are there any changes needed? For example, I'm just wondering, do you think there's too many super funds? Mm. Is competition working? Choice, is that working?
Yeah.
Great
questions. I like to go to the aggregates in the first instance. The most important thing about the super system is we've got by 2060 there'll be twice as many people over 65, and there'll be three times as many people over 80. So we're aging, and the cost of provision of age pension is going to go from 2.6%. of GDP to 2.1% of GDP. That's enormous. Every other country is running at 9s and 10s and 11s. So has the central promise been delivered? Well, in funding society as we age, absolutely it has. And we've now got an indexed, means-tested age pension, and the median balance is going to go from $160,000 or $165,000 to $465,000. So the central idea: is it good for the country? Yes, it's categorically good for the country. Is it good for business? Yes, it will be, and it is already an important way of funding business. And will households have more money? Yes, they will. As to the point of competition, it's a very competitive market. The rest of the world doesn't understand that here you can move funds in 3 days and you can create your own fund if you want, and you can choose a big fund or a small fund, or you can lose $1 billion by putting 12,000 people onto First Guardian and Shield. You can choose your own adventure in this system. It's competitive, and people wear.
Well, yeah, but just on that $1 billion loss for the 12,000 in Guardian and so on. I mean, that shouldn't happen, should it? Really?
No,
I mean,
it shouldn't happen.
It
should not happen, and it doesn't have to happen. And that's a very important place for government to step in and to protect consumers, because most people don't have the financial literacy to help them with those things. And some people get flogged very poor products, and sometimes people are being approached by comparator websites and getting called and say, oh, would you like to make $50,000 more? Well, of course I would. Well, come and buy this nonsense. It's really important that there's proper consumer protections, because that's a devastating thing to happen to somebody. So in the aggregate, the super system is very sound and good. It doesn't work. It's not perfect for everybody. It still favours older, wealthier, mostly men over women. So there's some equity issues for us to keep working through. But the competition part of it is pretty strong, and I think we're already seeing a consolidation to larger, better, smarter funds. I think that's naturally occurring. The flow of money is already occurring that way.
One thing I don't understand is that the industry super sector, of which you're obviously the largest, are not for profit. So you don't have to make a profit. You're not charities, but not for profit, and you're competing against the retail sector that does have to make a profit, and they still have $800 million and more than 3 million members. Yeah. How come you guys haven't obliterated the retail funds? Because you don't have to make a profit.
That's a really important. It's an important question, Alan. I prefer to describe us as profit to members, right? I'm ruthlessly in the pursuit of profit. Like, this is not just not for profit. This is ruthlessly in the pursuit of profit. It's just that every one of the profits goes into Percy's account or Tatiana's account.
But that's the point. I mean, the retail funds, the profit goes to
They definitely take something off. They do definitely take something off the top. Well, it's my job to make sure that we make people the most money risk adjusted over their lifetime and provide them with the service, help and guidance that they want, with a reputation and a brand that they love. And then I'm going to try and persuade as many people to join. But one of the great things about this system is it has private sector enterprise, it has profit to member funds, it has large funds, it has small funds, it has, there's a, you can create your own fund. And I think that's a great characteristic of a healthy, I love choice and competition. I'd also like to smash the competition, and I like everybody to be here because it makes more sense for them, but not everybody makes the best decision for themselves.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Paul. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Alan, and I really enjoyed it myself too.
Thanks so much for joining me on That's Business. You can find That's Business on the ABC Business Daily feed every Friday. So you don't miss out, make sure you follow ABC Business Daily to find us, or ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts. Carrington Clark and the ABC Business Daily team will be back in the feed on Monday.